There's this conversation around a glacier in Iceland running for president. And it's got like people gleefully saying it's a joke and they're also serious about it. And okay, so if you have suffrage or you're granted some citizenship standing or like political standing, I should really say, then like in theory, the political system has to be accountable to you, or it's like catering to your votes. And that's another kind of form of niche construction. So to have agency is to be detectable to the system, but in the process of being detectable, you alter it. And so we should like try to transform these systems, which I think have historically only been understood as socially oriented. And by social, we just by default mean humans only. And maybe one of the fundamental underlying premises of this kind of thinking is that the social does not just only include people. So law, economic, political technologies that are like a kind of social technology, they're enlisted towards a broader notion of the public, which would include whales or not just charismatic megafauna, but like bioregions, ecosystems, forests, etc.
Greetings, future fossils, and welcome to episode 220 of the podcast that explores our place in time. I'm your host, Michael Garfield, and this week we are speaking with Austin Wade Smith, animist, designer, ecologist, and creative technologist based in Brooklyn, New York. Austin is the executive director of Regen Foundation, which some of you might remember from my recent episode with Gregory Landouet and speaker John Ash. Regen is a U.S.-based nonprofit designing a just transition to sovereign regenerative economics supported by emerging decentralized technologies of governance, sensing, and ownership. Austin's work explores opportunities for social, legal, economic, and information technologies to foster greater independence between individuals and our living world. They teach design and engineering courses related to their research at universities in New York. Today, we talk about Austin's recent articles on autonomous or convivial ecological institutions, the land stewardship equivalent of a self-driving car, as we put it in this conversation. If y'all go back to episode 178, where I interview Chris Ryan, paleoanthropologist and host of Tangentially Speaking, which incidentally, I just recorded an episode for, which is extremely exciting. I've been a fan of Chris's for many, many years. But anyway, the point is, Chris's book, Civilized to Death, talks about the way that our institutions have taken over. They're in the driver's seat of our planet. People really are not and have not been for arguably thousands of years. And so the question becomes, how do we live symbiotically with our institutions in a way that is suited to the mental, emotional, and physiological well-being of people and as well to the diversity and health of our living world? As someone who spends an enormous amount of time researching and thinking about the evolution of artificial intelligence, and as someone who, following the writings of people like Cosmos Schelezi and Xander Paco Nathan, regard our corporations and our states as forms of artificial intelligence, and who maintains that we actually live in a post-singular world, where many of us spend most of our time trying to stay out from underfoot of these eldritch entities that barely recognize our existence and certainly do not care for us. The question of how we might use recent technological advancements in machine learning and in distributed ledgers to make human beings and the ecosystems we depend on legible and valuable to the new archons of the technosphere, why that is a question of existential concern. You know what else is a question of existential concern? Your support for this podcast. Future Fossils has been a labor of love, entirely listener supported, since 2016. And I am making as much money with this show as I was 6 years ago when I had no children and no mortgage. I am incredibly grateful to every single person who donates on a monthly basis or drops large sums randomly into my Venmo. And if you have the means, thanks to the mysterious boons of this latest wave of technological value creation, please, please consider signing up or raising your monthly pledge or connecting me with grants and fellowship programs that I can apply for which you believe Future Fossils is philosophically and ethically aligned. I am hard at work now pitching my next book, Jurassic Worlding, A Paleontology of the Present, to publishers, as well as a new podcast, Humans on the Loop, a show about human agency in the age of AI, and how we can live harmoniously with radical new technologies and use them to enact the best of all possible futures. This is an enormous, hugely important conversation, and I'm really, really eager to focus and synthesize everything I've learned as the host of Future Fossils and as the host of Complexity into this very urgent and vital conversation. But in order to do that, I need quit your job money. In order to fully dedicate myself to this calling and frankly to get myself into a much healthier headspace around how I'm spending my time and the value I am contributing in my service to society, I need your help to finally make Future Fossils sustainable and or to make Humans on the Loop and Jurassic Worlding my living wage gigs. Thank you in advance for sharing this incredible conversation and my work generally and the work of Regen Foundation with whomever you feel has the insight and the influence to help each and all of us pull our particular oars on the long ship of regenerative planetary culture. michaelgarfield.substack.com/subscribe, patreon.com/michaelgarfield, or you can reach me directly to inquire about sponsorships and other forms of support at michaelgarfield@gmail.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy this fabulous conversation with Austin Wade Smith of the Regen Foundation. And be sure to subscribe to Future Fossils if you aren't doing it already, because the next couple of episodes include trippy and illuminating discussions with Andres Gomez-Emilson of the Qualia Research Institute, Chris Ryan of Tangentially Speaking, Helene Wabe, I hope I'm saying your name right, of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Timothy Morton of Rice University, Robert Poynton on his fantastic new book, Do Conversation, Joshua DeCaglio on his book, Scale Theory, and more. You will not want to miss them. And you will not want to miss the dozens and dozens of amazing conversations I have planned out for Humans on the Loop. So one more time, help me fund that show and this one. Thank you so much. Enjoy. Austin Wade Smith. I want to start. Is that okay? Can we start?
We can start.
Awesome. Austin, it's been a minute. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. This is kind of like capping off like a really high output week in a high output like season, I would say, like a whole spring, in a way that's nice to pause and have some time for reflection and to unpack things in a little bit of a longer format. So it's like a treat for me. I'm stoked to be here.
Right on. Yeah, it's so, the timing is always just so uncanny for me. I've been trying to get in to record with a friend of mine, Lance Keltner, who is this badass Austin, former Austin-based musician who used to play shows with Stevie Ray Vaughan and Eric Johnson all the time back in the 80s. And he and I have been talking about getting in on his new studio in Santa Fe now since like October, like right after I met you around that time. And I went in yesterday to cut the first track with him, which is named after James C. Scott's book, Seeing Like a State.
Sounds inspired.
You know, so like my, like there is this, like kernel happening here at the end of April that's all about legibility and systemic sense making, and you know what it looks like to redesign our institutions to be more, as you put it, convivial. Yeah, and just to put a cherry on top of that, I just hung out with Chris Ryan, who wrote that book Civilized to Death. He was passing through Santa Fe to record a show, and that was our whole conversation on 178, which was, you know, the institutions are the dominant life form on our planet now, so how do we help them
help us,
you know, he's like, how do we redesign the built environment so that as he puts it, so that we're living in the San Diego Zoo rather than the Calcutta Zoo. But I love this paper that you have shared, the ecological institutions protocols to grow autonomous and convivial ecological actors, which we will link to in the show notes. And I want you to unpack this. But before we do that, I want you to give people a bit of human level framing on Austin Wade Smith, on who you are, because I had the luxury of getting to meet you on ground level last fall. And I'd like to offer the same as by proxy.
Right on. Sure. I'm really happy you like the paper, and I'm happy to get into it. Yeah. So my name is Austin Wade Smith. I also go by AWS pretty often. My pronouns are they, them. I am oftentimes confused with being Amazon Web Service and email correspondences, and I love that. I think like being conflated for one of the largest providers of cloud computing infrastructure is a kind of like, that's a kind of confusion I'm into. I'm trained as an ecologist, an ecophysiologist, and an architect. So when you're talking about the built environment, it definitely like resonates with me. I guess I identify as an animist and an artist. And I think probably the bigger theme that threads through my creative practice, that certainly in the piece that we'll talk about today and the work I do professionally, is around the kind of notion of animism, and not just as a sort of relationship between a perceiver and a perceived thing, but like how it's embedded into infrastructure, how we embed it into technical systems. So I do that in a kind of more formalized way, but at the Regen Foundation, which is the nonprofit arm of the larger Regen network. And I would say, like, in very concise terms, what the Regen network tries to do is the opposite of fining people for harming the planet, which means we're trying to like reward and support people who are healing the planet. And that seems like that's so obvious that we should be doing that, but it actually turns out it's really hard. It's really hard and on all these different levels, but the basic premise is really simple, that we need more holistic accounting, not like fake accounting that just sheds whatever externality is inconvenient for a corporate actor, but we need accounting that makes our financial life look a little bit more like ecological life. So I explore that in my work at the foundation, and I really like it. I have a hard time putting it down. But then I also have like an artist practice, and I'm interested in a lot of different things. I'm surrounded by a bunch of little servers, little Raspberry Pis around here that are doing various things. That's kind of like part of the AWS thing, is making myself an endpoint on the web and playing in that kind of slippage. I call that project Feral Computing, which I think Feral Servers and Feral Technology is pretty active in the piece. I'm based in Brooklyn, and I absolutely love orchids and flying kites. You can't see it in the interview, but there's a kite behind me right now.
I'm trying to transition to video. So cool. If you don't mind, I might post this so that people can see your kite.
Okay, it's right there. I got it in Hong Kong. Yeah. So, yeah, I'm, I got a little kite atelier going on. I'm trying to make the side hustle more of a main hustle. And there's something like very sensuous about flying kites. They say it's like the opposite of lifting weights, which I kind of love. It's like pulling lifts. It just sort of inverts a lot of assumptions about the way things work on their head, and in the process makes things just joyous and fun. Like, you don't see people flying kites frowning very often. They're like always somehow like kind of touching the air. They're just like surfing this big commons that we all are collectively not trying to completely fuck up. Anyway, yeah, kites are fun.
So a bit of backstory on this piece then. Mm-hmm. Did this, like, which came first, your work with Regen or your thinking about autonomous ecological institutions? Like, mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, they're definitely co-evolved, and the ecological institutions paper is certainly an articulation of like a lot of the sort of, I think it's like a formalization of a lot of things that are ambiently, I think, really motivating to a lot of people who are a part of the Regen network. So they're like, I think maybe I'm trying to synthesize through a kind of framework and a language which is quite personal, but I think it's tapping into like what a lot of my colleagues and dear friends are like feeling and resonating on. And thinking through like how to do work that seems ethical and like with purpose. Sometimes that can feel daunting. And I came upon the rights of nature movement maybe like 8 years ago, and I was just completely obsessed with the premise. I thought it was like the smartest thing I'd ever heard, and very, very clever, like has this kind of wit to it that's like energizing and kind of animating. So I've been interested in the notion of non-human agency and how that's expressed through different systems for quite a long time. And that's what got me into Regen in the first place, because I was like, maybe this could happen through economic terms too, not just through legal terms. It doesn't have to be all rights-based. It could be a value-based premise of non-human agency too. Well, what would the two look like together? Maybe we should synthesize like earth law, some of what's happening in the earth law movement with the regenerative economic movement, and that's the basis of the idea. So Regen is building an open source stack for like regenerative economic accounting, like real, not fake accounting, but like trying to define what right relation or regeneration looks like in a particular context. And the really, really big emphasis there is that the terms of that are governed locally. They're not imposed from a top down or from an external we know best premise, but it's more like a collaboration between local contests and context and like guilds of different partners or stakeholders. But anyway, yeah, the premise that of what Regen Network is building as a sort of open source framework, I think basically plugs into the container that the Earth Law system has made, but has struggled in some ways to enforce or to like make impactful, because it's still relying upon conventional legal financing for lawsuits, which are expensive. And, you know, maybe the designation of having legal standing, which is effectively what the rights of nature is. It says it has standing, it has the right to flow or the right to stand if it's a tree or a river or whatever. You know, it's like signifying that we understand this relationship to be like a being that should have a seat at the table, and that's nominal and symbolic in a lot of ways, but maybe that could be plugged into the same idea, can be like proliferated across many other mediums to try to make like a mutually reinforcing type of actor. And that's, I guess, like we've been talking about, like how do the rights of nature and Regen intersect? And so this paper I've probably been working on for 2.5 years or so, in collaboration with the Earth Law Center. Shout out Grant Wilson and Kevin Schneider, who are active collaborators and sort of like the legal side, legal experts in this project.
So I would just like to read little snippets from mm-hmm. this and then have you riff on them, because this is not to just like blow smoke up your ass, but there are some really eloquent turns of phrase here, and I think it's a very articulate piece of work, and it would just be nice to let you kind of annotate yourself.
Sure. Here. Cool.
Yeah. So I like this one. I've been thinking a lot about agency in light of AI and, you know, the debate over, you know, people are kind of throwing this term around like AI agents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the debate over whether what we're dealing with really are agents, or whether, you know, AI broadly understood is more of a sort of inert cultural technology, like a library or, some other kind of, written language or this kind of thing, you know, whether it's a layer of knowledge compression, or whether it's like, you know, and to me, this seems like just
an actor. Okay.
Yeah. Just to frame this, it's like, if you want to get like William Burroughs or Terrence McKenna, then you might take the position that my buddy Jacob Foster at IU Bloomington takes, that memes are agents, you know, that ideas live on they're organisms, they live on the substrate of human brains. And, there's something that's useful in that way of seeing. On the other hand, it's scary, it's paranoid. It's easy for people who are afraid of Terminators to slip into a dark place thinking in that way if they haven't already made this sort of metanoia turn. And, they're comfortable with their own, you know, holobiont, like the notion that the germs living in their gut are not like other to them. You know, so like this whole notion of where to draw the lines in a sort of, you know, innately planetary ecological way of seeing, you know, how do we understand technology in relation to ourselves? These are like crucial philosophical questions right now. So I love that you up close to the beginning of this paper, you say this project begins from a proposition that we call. What we call agency is oftentimes less a reflection of an organism's innate capacities or attributes, but rather their ability to be legible to the contexts within which they operate, living or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is just, again, to go back to like James C. Scott and seeing like a state, this notion that agency is not a sort of objective property of a person, that a person has more or less agency within a structure. Mm-hmm. And so I'd love to hear you speak to that.
Sure. Yeah. The domain of who is considered to have agency is a historical force, and the like dispossession of that agency or the awarding of agency and who has the power to do it certainly has been going on for a long time. And this is maybe continuous with that. That quote's a great starting point, because it's kind of the first principle of the whole process. And maybe underneath that is a question around intent and will, that could be, you know, like determinism and stuff, bigger philosophical question. But agency is not a stable config. It's actively navigated, it's actively conferred, it's contested, it's precarious, and it moves in different mediums like rights or value, as two common examples that I'm using here in this project. So with the instability that comes with agency comes an opportunity to like use it as a medium, rather than just this sort of thing that something is or isn't endowed with, that it's actually like a consequence of a kind of like how we're constituted by these other regulatory infrastructures. And like, I can have agency if I am a citizen or if I have a green card. There's different degrees of that agency and participating in other, in like political processes. And so I think like cracking open the stability of agency as a kind of discrete, you know, like just like an innate thing that is stable, into actually making it be like, oh, this is a medium that we should be playing in. And we should be like exploring how to like maximize agency in various forms. And to do that, you explore and research the way that agency is manifest. So like in the non-human standing example, like rights are what court systems see. So if you can create a system by which non-humans or like a broader range of humans or like any kind of actor has rights, then it has agency within the court of law. And that means that in thus like the legal system is in somewhat in service, or it's in working on behalf of this actor or these sets of actors. And I like the idea that it would be like a medium that you would that we would try to explore this as a design process. I'm a designer like at my root. So it's in making that term less stable and more like conferred and contested, it becomes a process, less of like an attribute or a noun. And maybe there's a little bit of like relationship to what you're talking about around the sort of like, is a meme an actor, or is it like a particular kind of compression system that there's a sort of active form, like a verb form of agency that we should be exploring and like tuning, playing with, finding resonance patterns inside of. And like lawyers have been like, legal hackathons are a thing. I just learned about this like a year ago. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Okay. Like there's a culture of this hacking of agency that's not just in like, you know, in the shell or whatever, it's moving across other systems. So it's sort of, this is an effort to try to weave many of those together so that they resonate and have a greater level of impact or potential ramifications.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I think you handle really adroitly in this is there's that bumper sticker that says, you know, if I'll believe that corporations are people when Texas executes one. And you know, I gave a talk on this kind of stuff at Burning Man back in 2017. I'll link to in the show notes, where I was saying, you know, I'm up to a point. I'm actually okay with the idea of corporate personhood, if you know, we actually grant people the same kind of protections under the law that we do corporations. And the real the gap there seems to be in the amount of economic power and agency that corporations can leverage, such that you get these bizarro situations like Warner Brothers defending a non-existent copyright to the song Happy Birthday for a century, mm-hmm. just because they can lawyer up more than any other, you know, any other, you know, like agencies at a different scale.
Right.
You know, and so this is, you know, this is the situation in which we found ourselves, where someone manages to hack the legal end of it, but we haven't found a way to hack economic legibility of individual, you know, corporations at the scale of an individual person, or, you know, at these other, you know, the scale of a watershed or whatever. You know, so I like that you give examples of, you know, why can't we grant blue whales and old growth Douglas firs the same kind of legal standing we grant corporations? And then later on, you mention the possibility of using legal wrappers such as unincorporated associations and zero member LLCs as, quote, promising structures from which novel ecological institutions might emerge. Yeah, I mean, so there's this issue, and this is sort of, you know, where we get into your argument that we need to find, and that we have ways you know, we've started that you and your colleagues have started to think about ways that these, you know, like if we're gonna talk about granting legal personhood to Pachamama or whatever, Pachamama has to afford its own lawyers. You know, it has to afford its own guardians, its and stewards, and so on.
You have to pay taxes.
Right. Right. So it's not just legal legibility, it's economic and political legibility. And I'd love to hear you get into the gritty of that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, right. So I think the notion of legibility is probably one of the most powerful thought instruments like we have at our disposal. Just like in general. And so the idea, the reframing of the agency comment is like that agency is a reflection of legibility and how legible, understandable, recognizable you are to the system that you're inside of. And inevitably in the process of being recognizable or like legible, you alter the features of the environment that you're inside of. And a kind of aha for me that I really enjoyed through the process of putting this together and this journey that has sort of supported it is thinking through in first principles like earth native and ecologically native processes, which describe this phenomenon quite clearly that then I can like graph back on to like more human derived systems, anthropogenic systems. And so niche construction, I think, is a really big one, which is like me wearing my ecologist hat. That's like, you know, the beaver who constructs the dam is altering the features of its habitat in such a way that it's changing the sort of the landscape within which it operates. And then the extent to which that you're able to like impact and like transform your environment means you're shaping the landscape that within which you exist. And we're pretty familiar of thinking about that stuff from a biological level, like we alter our own environment. But that same idea of niche construction could be employed across other kinds of infrastructures and technologies, like creating a legal niche for non-humans. Like the corporate personhood has already created a niche that can be occupied by more things than just corporate actors. And similar process to say like, well, if we could come up with a system by which the living world that sustains us, that sustains human beings and life on earth, like that has value. We'll call it like care work or like reproductive care work to sustain us on a systemic level that in effect, we're exploring like niche construction in an economic domain too. Or if there's notion of like representation or suffrage and you know, like there's this conversation around a glacier in Iceland running for president. And it's got like people gleefully saying it's a joke and they're also serious about it. And okay, so if you have suffrage or you're granted some citizenship standing or like political standing, I should really say, then like in theory, the political system has to be accountable to you or it's like catering to your votes. And that's another kind of form of niche construction. So to have agency is to be detectable to the system, but in the process of being detectable, you alter it. And so we should like try to transform these systems, which I think have historically only been understood as socially oriented. And by social, we just by default mean humans only. And maybe one of the fundamental underlying premises of this kind of thinking is that the social does not just only include people. So law, economic, political technologies that are like a kind of social technology, they're enlisted towards a broader notion of the public, which would include whales or not just charismatic megafauna, but like bioregions, ecosystems, forests, et cetera. And yeah, I think there's a lot of like power in that, in the sense that it's maybe part of this exercise is to take the terms of social life that humans have so narrowly maintained, to take them as far as they can logically go on their own terms, so that they undo themselves and like take corporate personhood dead seriously in a way that like allows it to basically work in a broader service to like life. And I think that that's like I think that's a really exciting premise. And maybe I'll conclude this riff by saying that I think this is like an instrument. Like this is like a framework with a set of instruments that we might tune and use as necessary in the climate justice process, which is social justice. They're like one and the same. And so they're helpful. People oftentimes don't like that these worlds touch. Legibility is like kind of like a dark forest where if something is recognizable to an economic system, it's therefore now destroyable, exploitable. And people don't like that. And I don't like it either in some ways, but I think maybe kind of like a broad hands, jazz hands, broad stroke response to that. Your question is like that I'm really tired of the kind of preciousness of the separation of like, oh, well, social technologies, and then there's nature, and we'll keep nature like there. Like we are nature. We're fundamentally a part of it. We are part of the, we are part of watersheds. We're part of rivers. We're part of forests. They don't just exclude us. So the kind of anxiety around like not allowing the living world to be integrated into social technologies, I think actually kind of perpetuates a sort of separatism of us versus nature. Like nature should be over there and should be left alone. It's like, no, we are nature. We're implicated in this. And so there's a sort of spirit of like play and exploration that I think comes into it. And I kind of wish, it's not like a goal, but if people think that this is completely absurd, what we're talking about here, then maybe something's gotten across. They're like, whoa, okay, like this actually registered. That like, well, you know, there's examples in the Rights of Nature movement where people are just like, this is, are kind of dumbfounded by the premise. And that probably means there's something there to like double click on or like lean into. Yeah, that's what your comment makes me think of.
Yes. Okay. So I'm really glad that you brought up this, the double-edged sword of legibility, because obviously like as soon as you can stand up and be counted as it were, then you're also, someone who has a target on your back.
Right.
Right. And so in a similar way, when I had your friend and colleague Gregory Landouet on the show in episode 217 to introduce Regen to the Future Fossils audience, we talked about this thing that, you know, I've been kind of prosecuting with him for a while now, which is in what ways do you all, meaning, you know, you and everyone working with you on the Regen project broadly, understand the marketization of land stewardship? Like how do you design that to protect against economic predations through, you know the kind of predatory speculation that we see going on with, you know, carbon sequestration or other kinds of ecosystem services, you know? And I liked that, I like that you bring up the complexity of the situation in this paper, and you caution against collapsing ecological complexity into sort of a single variable assessments. Mm-hmm. In that way, you know, Gregory made the point that, you know, that if, for instance, as is the case with like the jaguar credit in the Amazonian headwaters, that the land stewards are the ones making the decision about what does and does not count as a, yes, as a viable metric for this, the health of the ecosystem that they're protecting. Then what you have is this enormously heterogeneous patchwork of locally determined metrics, and that becomes a much harder thing to collapse at the scale of a global market into something that's going to steer the whole thing off course. But then here you have, in this case, you know, if the ecosystem is self-governing, the question that I have, and maybe we're kind of skipping ahead here, because there's, I do want to kind of drill. Cool. That's a horrible verb here.
Really, but I do want to find some of these ideas and just take.
Go ahead. Yeah, I want to. Yeah, I want to extract some. No, I want to. I want to clarify some of this. You know, the fundamentals here before getting into this. But well, whatever. We're here. We're here. How do you imagine you talk about oracles and mm-hmm. the ways that you could set up ledger-based systems and sensors and so on so that an ecosystem can monitor itself and make sense of itself. And I'd like to hear more about how, specifically you say, in effect, autonomous ecological institutions are a kind of self-driving ecology. But like a self-driving car is being trained on the behavior of human drivers.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have this sort of problem with levels of autonomy with self-driving yeah. vehicles. And, you know, even though Mercedes is now selling like level 3 self-driving cars in the States, supposedly that you can actually fall asleep at the wheel. How do you imagine us getting to the point where we can trust the machine layer mm-hmm. that we've built on top of all of this and that we are using to interface with these institutions as legal and economic entities to actually give us metrics that make sense? Like how do we trust this thing to steer?
Yeah, totally. It's a good question. Well, the double, I'm going to start out with a kind of like weak sauce response that I think is helpful in just illustrating my general position on some of this broader framing and question is if there is the opportunity for people to meaningfully disagree on whether or not an approach around local definitions of regeneration should be defined as having value and then sold. If there can be an opportunity where people disagree on like making things legible or not, then I think the foundation has been successful in some ways. Because in order to disagree, you have to agree on like 100 other things in order to even have the same language and the same premise to disagree on something rather than just people talking past each other. So my goal, and I think the goal of the foundation is to fundamentally support public literacy around the ethical and technical underpinnings around like regenerative economics so that they like people are aware of what's at play and they can fork it, they can dismantle it, they can evolve it, they can participate in it, but we have an informed conversation around it. So the kind of double-edged nature of legibility that I think of like legibility as a dark forest that now you're open to like predation, I think is incredibly alive and present in the awareness of the work that we do, I do, Gregory and others do. And people bring that up a lot, like it's a new thought. And I think the tension that is in that question is like a very animating tension that I think we have to go through in order to actually not be separate from nature. Like we have to navigate that tension to really, really undual society and ecology and like recognize that we are the earth and we are forests and we are ecosystems. So that discomfort is worth sticking with. I'm not here to say one should come out on one side or the other, that we're putting a market in the temple of what is sacred and we're therefore violating it. If we take this sort of self-evident truth that we are a part of the living world fundamentally, then it's going to smash us into some of these questions around the discomfort around legibility. And I'm pretty much committed that that question is something I'm going to kind of dedicate my life to unpacking in public and in more direct or one-on-one conversations and through practice and action and stuff. So the idea being that value can only really be defined on a fundamental level locally. And okay, you could say what's local, what's the boundaries of local, or you could just kind of, people can hand wave and say grassroots, but that a lot of the source of harm and dispossession around valuing living systems or carbon sequestering organisms, whatever that might look like, or a carbon credit or whatever, is that it's predicated upon an imposition of what's right and effectively a kind of neo-colonialist conservation mindset that bypasses the people who are doing the direct work and just is effectively like a money laundering scheme for corporates who are trying to chip away at their net zero commitments. And so I, broadly speaking, regen as a premise is designed so that the governance and the definition of what regeneration or what we call right relation looks like is happening at a local level. And that's durable. That's like not getting co-opted or like manipulated or tampered with. And we can use decentralized ledgers with integrity to do that. So in the piece, I distinguish between data oracles and social oracles. And there's a kind of extension between autonomous systems and convivial systems there. And so like, I think I'm actively working on building oracles that would allow like a DAO or a set of contracts to do things based off of like environmental data, like input, like if the wind blows north, do this set of actions. And okay, that's like interesting. Does it really, you know, it gets much more complicated, much more complex, much very quickly. Like that's kind of what you're pointing out when you're saying like, okay, well, there's like a one dimension of trying to define right relation in terms of one dimension is crazy reductive. So in the piece, I talk a lot about decentralized protocols, which is like a way of saying like blockchain identity, ownership, sensing and verification and governance, like a lot of these things that are able to be maintained through decentralized consensus rather than through a centralized authority, that, you know, those processes can be fundamentally in service to and support of like social oracles, not just data oracles. So the autonomous ecosystem, autonomous ecological institution idea, at kind of the end of the paper, I sort of like say like, that's kind of missing the point, y'all. But how crazy is it that we've found ourselves with the technical capabilities to make truly like autonomous ecosystems that could do things that, and they could directly put pressure on human society to do things through their own pre-programmed or like contractual basis? We have that possibility now, and coupling regenerative economics and earth law together opens up this whole renaissance where we could do that. But we are not separate. Like we're not trying to build autonomous things. We're trying to reintegrate, to live with. And that's why I kind of landed on the term convivial. I mean, it has other meanings with Ivan Illich and stuff like that. But I'm thinking of it sort of like not autonomous. Like it's sort of like autonomy isn't the point. We're not trying to make something more separate from us, but actually reweave ourselves back into the fabric of things. So the friction that can come with people defining what regeneration looks like through a governance process, through a consensus making, through ritual practices, whatever that might look like that's the good stuff, and how that might inform and direct the behavior of these larger sort of new institutional actors. Let's see. But I put the autonomous ecological institutions out there because we can technically do that. And it is basically like, yeah, you could use an LLM or an AI that was built on a model of knowledge systems or of being able to look at Earth observation and deduct behaviors that should happen based off of what it's observing and stuff. Like you could train the model to make these autonomous things. And that's sort of like planting like a rogue legal financial instrument into the soil and like seeing what it does, which is like fun. Is a conceptual practice. But that the convivial part is where like the cart is always turning towards that. And so I love this kind of paradox that we like coupling the what's happening in like Earth economics and Earth law together allows us to create these sort of autonomous actors, only to really be humbled and fundamentally realize that there's that kind of autonomy is like missing the point, that we're trying to re-spin ourselves into the living world. And so I wrote another piece called Common Sense, which describes how oracles are commons. and community oracles. So the interaction between the two of them, that there could be data inputs that are taken from sensor networks or Earth observation, coupled with traditional ecological knowledge systems or forms of storytelling or people forming consensus, and that those things can and should be thickened and woven together. And that we're like, we're really trying to get like something heterogeneous here, where it's not just like only autonomous or only convivial, or that there's a relational system of value and a transactional system of value, and the transactional system is going to pillage the relational one. Like, it's actually more heterogeneous and patchy than that. And that the tendency to push it towards a kind of binary of like autonomous or convivial, or like relational and transactional, which I know I'm kind of introducing these as terms now, but people have a strong predilection to like take that philosophical scenario to its conclusion and come up with a binary that seems incommensurable, when actually there's a lot of people who are excited to try to find something that's rough and ready and hacky and working, that at its first principles is like respecting and honoring people who are doing the damn work on the ground. And maybe that's alive in the notion about how one could make credits, like this double-edged thing of legibility. Yeah, is a potent and meaningful philosophical framing, but in context, it's heterogeneous and inconsistent to itself. And there's certainly transactional logics within what we would consider to be, you know, spaces where that's not expected to occur. And there's relational thinking that happens, you know, within societies or modern societies. Like, it's weirder than that. It's way weirder than just this like fun binaries that people in deploy. And I think we're kind of like paralyzed ourselves from the joy of the philosophical like conviction, or like the incommensurability of them. And actually, it's like this weird gucky suspension of different kinds of things in different locations. And you have to actually listen and show up and like participate as if your own life depended on it, rather than being like, oh, here's my understanding of what this philosophy is, and this is how this is going to work.
I kind of went off on direction. I mean, just to take a, you know, a piece, hopefully a sizable piece of what you just said, you know, it sounds to me like the real juice here is akin to, you know, something else I've been talking about with people a lot lately, just in terms of where I see the greatest value in AI models of various kinds, not just language models, you know, video models, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, so when my buddy Van Bettauer took the entire corpus of Future Fossils and made a chatbot out of it,
cool.
I realized that basically what he had done was he had taken the work that I was doing for the social media audience of the Santa Fe Institute when I was working there, and automated it so that there's a little librarian that's sitting there providing retrieval augmented generative responses with you know, timestamp citations, somebody that knows the material, and rather than speaking with the authority of the organization, can point you to primary sources, which functions as a kind of content destroyer. Like it provides, like I love, I just blogged about this. I forget who it was on Twitter that said, we don't need more content creators, we need content destroyers. Like, what we're dealing with right now is an information scaling crisis. Because this goes back to like, what was it? Episode 60, I think, when I talked with Daniel Schmachtenberger about how we had decoupled our ability to sense from our ability to act. And so like, you know, people experience this enormous despair because we're plugged into, I go over to my buddy's house and he's watching news about the Israel-Palestine thing, and there is not a damn thing he can do about it. And the complexity of that situation is like really beyond the ability of the news to adequately report. And, you know, certainly it's not clear, you know, where we allocate our, you know, our limited individual energies to these sort of, various global concerns as they erupt across our cybernetic sensorium. And yet now we have these, the inklings of tools that can help us navigate what, Richard Doyle called the infoquake. Mm-hmm. And, so I see, like, if I'm to understand you correctly, the conviviality of these ecological institutions and the, bringing the human and the landscape back together in our understanding and in our, in our economic and political and legal processes, this is the oracle allowing us to, like you just said, listen and learn what actually matters to the health of that system, rather than to, drop in and say, what matters here? The wood. We're going to take the rosewood. That's what matters here. And so this is so pertinent to a much, much larger, I won't say it's larger, but it's like, it's a much more general conversation that I've been having with people, even like well outside of what seems at first pass, like the conversation about ecological institutions, which is, again, how do we make, as you put it, you cite braiding sweetgrass, Robin Kimmerer, you say, in order to be heard, you must speak the language of those who you want to listen. And like the biggest thing that keeps popping up again and again and again and seemingly every conversation I have is this question of how can we teach corporations to care about the variables upon which their own long-term survival depends? Because like right now, all they can see are, it's like this thing of like, well, how do we make trust in the, I talked about this at the Regen Summit with Amber Case and Michael Zargum, how do we make the trust that users have in their platform a bigger part of the governance of these tech platforms? And so I don't know, like I am kind of rambling here. We've reached that point of the show, but like I want to pin back again to comments that you made in this paper on digital knowledge commons and open source software governance, and how that overlaps in your thinking with community resource management and biophysical commons. And again, this is where, it seems like you can't factor out the human on the loop piece of it. Mm-hmm. Because you're saying, here's the Austin quote: to say that non-humans, ecosystems, and bioregions have value is to leverage an economic system for the protection and regeneration of the planet. To make the more than human world legible to economic systems is to reject the notion that planetary health is an externality to financial calculus. Rather, the economic system is compelled to be a steward of systems of value outside extraction. So basically, the climax here, I think, is me inviting you to riff on how this kind of thinking gives people hope that, broadly speaking, we can help organizations better understand the landscape of people of which they are composed, that we create oracles where corporate leadership can read the sentiment of their own staffing. Mm-hmm. Or that governments can get a better sense for the well-being of their constituencies than we currently do with GDP. Like Eric Beinhacher's work at the Institute for New Economic Thinking at Oxford talks a lot about eudaimonic economics. And it seems like you're providing a scaffolding, like an actual infrastructure for this that helps us actually think about how to implement this kind of stuff.
Right. I think you're kind of talking about like, what are the patterns and the practices of sense making as a verb and as something that we collectively do together? And we can describe that process at different scales, like you're giving the example of a corporation and like how to sense make, like internally, what's happening? Where is sentiment? Where is the desire for an organization for it to evolve, or like from who it's composed of? And this like there isn't, you know, there's, it's so wrought for manipulation. But I think part of this idea is of this kind of institution, ecological institutions, plays on this notion that there's like a durable way to determine state. Not to say that state is always going to be the same, or that things can be reduced to just like a single like description, because it's always weirder than that. But that there's like, it's kind of like oracles all the way down, that we can ecological institutions can be oracles. They can be driven by them, and they can be an interaction of humans forming consensus or practicing governance with one another through signaling processes that, honestly, like I mentioned, like modular politics and modular composable governance and some of the work of like Medigov comes to mind, block science too. It's really exciting around sense making and like forming coherence within groups of people around the state of things that can then be used to drive other stuff. And there's a certain like shining a light where there was darkness before, that like the systems that we have in place, which are greatly contributing to the degradation of the living world and people in the environment, broadly speaking, have a structural incentive to be blind to the consequences of what's happening. And that in the absence of that information, like, you know, you can't contest, you can't like push back on it. Like if you didn't know, then you're not really accountable. So rather than actually knowing and having to be accountable, there's a strong incentive for like things to not be sensed. And part of what's underlying this is like the radical project of collective sense making that's durable, not like permanent, not like even perfect or correct, but that it's more durable, that can be used to drive things like policy or institutional, you know, like behavior or resource allocation. And that we're in this like, we're invited to think through the kinds of commons that we're making, and to go back to the sort of like open source software and like commons governance thing. Like we're creating new kinds of commons for sense making, and that could be applicable internal to an organization, or it could be a definition on whether or not like a forest has been replanted or regenerated, or whether or not a coral reef has gone fully bleached or not. Like in a non-centralized, in a manner which does not rely on central authority, we're having some level of like verification of the state of the world that's hard to put down. It's like, or like it's impossible to ignore, so that might drive, it puts pressure directly on different systems to be accountable. So it's like we're trying to like willfully undo this structural ignorance, structural blindness that's not there by accident. And by making that legible, we invite this sort of challenge that it could be co-opted. But so many forms of exploitation happen because like the consequences are just considered not detectable to the system at play, you know, and it's an externality consequently. And so, yeah, I think that there's an invitation to think about data and observation systems and quantified metrics as problematic in some ways and helpful in other ways, as like not in fundamental contradistinction of like people forming consensus together or telling stories about what happened and forming a kind of coherence around that, that can be corroborated and informed by measurements in some kind and vice versa. And that we're building this kind of collective practice of sense-making that I describe here as oracles, and in this other piece, common sense as oracles, and they're commons that might borrow from the kind of commons that we know of, like Wikipedia, like knowledge commons, and like biophysical commons, like fisheries or forests or aquifers, that we're fusing those two spaces together. So I really like the idea of thinking of these institutions as like seeds for collective sense making in context, where there's a meaning, there's a sort of scaffold for collaboration across different modalities, quantitative and qualitative, local and global, or bioregional and guild based, as I've described it in other places, around this sort of sense making that drives new kinds of behaviors of institutions. And so this ecological institutions is sort of like, okay, well, we have these legal wrappers that allow us to have non-humans be able to do all these things. And they're going to take input from like this sense-making process that we're collectively supporting, nurturing, protecting, building, et cetera.
I have one more question for you, sort of like bonus round heater, put you on the spot thing. But I just want to say for folks, to bait you into reading this paper, if we haven't already, that you have an appendix with a bunch of implementations that are really, really interesting speculative scenarios. You've folks, go read this. You've got the smart aquifer, the political water body, the migration corridor chaperone, ecological data trusts, sacred ground, and an orca pod image licensor in Puget Sound, drought-based parametric insurance for farmers, a festival fund, regenerative homeowners association, bioregional fund, forest self-issues credits, land back and sovereign ground management. Like, oh my gosh. If you're trying to come up with ways to implement this stuff in your own life, Austin has basically given you a place to start. But the thing that's beleaguering me right now is the question that you just raised about the steep economic incentive to ignore externalities. You know, and like if you're kind of already there, if you've made this psycho-spiritual movement to seeing the importance of all of this, it's one thing.
We all have to cultivate, and this is not like a substitute for that personal work. And I talk about that in the piece.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess my question to you is, for those of us stuck inside of the belly of Leviathans like Google, Facebook, Amazon, how would you, hypothetical consultant Austin Wade Smith, come in and explain to these enormous monolithic institutions that this stuff matters, that there are things that they are not tracking and they should be?
That's fun. The salty answer would be like, okay, you all are so excited about longevity. Well, because you're going to live forever, you're going to inevitably face the consequences of your short-termism. So what kind of temporal cycle are you working on in terms of your reproductive care work? And then by that, I mean like reproducing the conditions in the biosphere that would allow human life to continue going. So that would be fun to be like, I maybe start with like some longevity types and be like, oh, you're in theory going to be facing the consequences of your short-termism. So let's begin there. Another version of that is like, I mean, I'm like, there's economic and legal leverage in this idea. And I'm not also skirting like getting around like government, the roles of governments to like make corporate actors or individuals accountable. Like that is very much a part of the scenario. It's not like it's trying to leverage new forms of legibility to increase pressure. The idea that you would try to make like cleaning the cleanup after the party profitable enough to the point where it's really going to compete, like, it's a hard sell. Like, hey, like, we're going to try to find an economic incentive landscape for people to be accountable for the mess that they've made, or like a handful of people and the organizations have had a huge mess making history. I say this in the piece, like, when people say there's no, like, how are you going to incentivize an economic, like, argument around this? I think that argument is making itself already, if we don't actively do things to do care work and sustain the living world, which sustains us. Like, we will put a value on standing forests that sequester carbon, or aquifers that sustain us with fresh water. Like, we'll put a value on these things and taking care of them. And I hope it doesn't require a total collapse in the biosphere in order for that to happen. So it's not an if it's going to happen, it's when is that going to happen? And can we do that consciously, because we're not complete idiots? Collectively, we have tremendous potential and see this. It's not coming, it's here, to like design that. Do it by design, not by default or by like emergency override, because we're fucked. And yeah, like, that's probably a blend of saying that there's trust that like the regeneration efforts that are playing out are real. Like, they're verifiable and their impact is verifiable, and it's like transparent in a meaningful way. And like understanding that, okay, well, as part of the life cycle of projects, like, it has, like, the whole life cycle has to be reintegrated. And now we have this sort of new set of like institutional actors that can support in that process. So yeah, I don't know if it like solves, I don't think it's like solving something per se, but it is giving a unique kind of container for a sort of, it's both a container and a kind of actor that can participate and sort of accelerate that process. And I talk about the notion of surface area in the piece, which is like, we're trying to multiply the surface area by which the non-human world puts pressure on human beings and our corporate ghosts to change. And part of a helpful way of doing that is to make the consequences impossible to ignore, or try to make them impossible to ignore, through durable attestations around the state of the world that you can't hide from or pretend you don't see. So, you know, how that plays out in terms of like, you know, being the health and safety inspector for different like corporates to be like, you have to be, you know, I mean, I think like it's absolutely going to be like compliance, not like all voluntary basis. And, you know, if we're going to like pay taxes, then one, we could pay taxes to nonprofit entities that follow a purpose and a mission that we believe in, like, not genocide or like any number of other sick systems that are currently happening. But we could consider like, okay, we're paying part of our taxes to the living world itself, and that there should be containers for like different bioregions and different biomes to be able to actually receive that payment. And then there's governance bodies in place that can like be transparent about a process of what's the best approach to regenerate them and support them. So like, underneath the hood of this is like this potential that now there's like a new kind of like anchor, a new kind of like trust or fund that's grown in the soil that can participate and potentially accelerate this process. But I don't know if it like solves it, because it's kind of like a hard nut to crack, the whole thing here.
Or we just give dolphins guns.
Yeah, first we're gonna spend a lot of time swimming with them, or like, yeah, or is it orcas that can just take on boats in the Mediterranean? There's a lot of like, yeah, examples of,
they're making it legible.
Yeah, they're making it very clear right onto that.
Well, Austin, this has been awesome. That was kind of an ole moment, but
we get a little ole. Yeah.
Do you have anything else to say in parting?
Yeah, I guess like one of the, I'm going to try to be concise about it. Like, I think that this idea, and in the piece throughout it, I reiterate like loops of stewardship and reciprocity. And so like the basic unit to build an ecological institution is not an individual actor, but a loop, a relational loop between an actor and their context, because they're not separate from each other. And that we can talk about how the earth sustains us, and we care for the earth, and it allows it to continue sustaining us. And that at work is a sort of fundamental revisiting of the basic unit of analysis about what composes society, rather than being like a self-interested actor or just like an actor as a discrete noun, but the verb that is a relational bi-directional process. And that is probably the most effective, stable, single unit of analysis and composition of these things. So like I think it's an exciting invitation to think about what composes institutions, not as a series of actors, but as a series of loops of stewardship and relationality. And that's like a fundamentally an ecological thought, not just because it's got a bunch of chlorophyll and like rain moving around, like it's like wet and leafy, but because we understand it's fundamentally bidirectional, and that like you can't escape that. We're trying, or people have tried for a long time, but we can't escape that. So we're trying to take that as a primitive relationality and like stewardship and reciprocity as the primitive of society, and then like build out institutions from that. And I think the original name for this project was called Earth Native Institutions, because it's like starting from that first principle of relationality being the driving process through which we create a social fabric or new kinds of quote eco-social assemblages. It's been really fun to be here. I had fun jamming. Thanks for the invitation. And I hope people are tempted to like try this on and be like, okay, well, what kind of like assumptions or premises are being held here? And how do they sit with you? Like, because I think some of it is definitely spot on. Some of it might be off, like, but it's an active effort to invite a more meaningful conversation around this stuff. And that really animates me. And so hopefully people feel compelled to like check it out and engage in the conversation and form their own opinions and start one up and like whatever they want to do, but that there's a will to act based off of it. So yeah, stoked to be here. And thanks for helping people learn more about this.
Absolutely. I mean, all I have to say in closing is I vastly prefer this sort of computer assisted driving with lane changing and parking and cruise control to doing it all myself or expecting the car to do it all for me, you know? And I think I'm placing my bet on this sort of design principle showing up in more and more of the systems that we find ourselves enmeshed in over the years to come. So kudos. Thanks for taking the time to be on the show. And everybody go check out this and the other essays on Austin's Mirror account, which again are linked in the show notes.
Thanks everybody.
Have a great day. Thanks again so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, I highly recommend bopping on over to austinwadesmith.com for a deeper encounter with a fascinating person and their fascinating ideas. Also, you can check the show notes, if you haven't, on Substack or Patreon for copious links and additional research resources. Or you can interface with the Future Fossils chatbot at askfuturefossils.com and let the retrieval augmented generative language model that encodes me and hundreds of wonderful guests help you navigate your own geography of rabbit hole curiosities. Very nicely curated time-stamped embedded player citations for every answer it provides your inquiries. Or you can hire The Real Thing. You know how to get a hold of me. Thanks again so much for listening. Take care. Talk soon.